WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How does the situation in Somalia look to a Somali writer living in exile? Joining us on the phone from Nigeria is one of Somalia's foremost writers, Nuruddin Farah. He was last in his country in 1974, the year one of his novels made dictator Siad Barre so angry he vowed to throw Farah in prison if he ever returned. Farah was studying in London at the time. He's written a trilogy of novels about the dictatorship. They've recently been published in America by Grey Wolf Press. Farah published his first novella in 1965, 7 years before Somalia had a written language of its own. He writes mostly in English. Farah says he'd love to return home to Mogadishu, but not during civil war. Most of his family has escaped from Somalia, but a brother and sister are still in the country. He's been unable to contact them. I asked Farah how he feels as he hears the reports of people starving in his country and foreign troops arriving.
I suppose many people are struck by the generosity of the Americans, struck by the mindfulness of the Americans of what's happening in Somalia. I also suppose that probably this is part of the post-Thanksgiving generosity on the part of a well-fed nation of Americans who, when they sat down to their meals, probably in November, they asked themselves the question, could they continue eating well when 1.5 to 3 million people are dying somewhere in Africa? But I tend to be more cynical than most people. And in my cynicism, and at least when I am in my cynical mood, I tell myself that it is also the very Americans who have somehow are part to blame, because it was their December show in 1991 when the fanfare of television, CNN television and ABC, brought us the war, the Gulf War. Now, it is not a coincidence that a year and a half ago, when Somalia was happening, when it was beginning to get, situation was getting worse and worse, it was the Americans who took the attention of the world from Somalia and who helped the attention of the world in television and media to be focused on what was taking place in the Middle East.
Do you think that, given the way things progressed and how little attention had been paid before, do you think at this point sending in troops was the right thing to do?
There are some people who would disagree with this, but I think this should have happened about a year ago.
Uh-huh.
It should have happened. Not, I didn't expect Americans to be the ones who would go in. I was expecting Africans to be the ones who should be going in. I was expecting the other countries in the Middle East, for example, Somalia is a member of the Arab League, to be the ones who would be looking after the interests of Somalia, in the same way as the Europeans are looking after the interests of Yugoslavia. Because, you know, when you have neighbors, Somalia has been let down not only by its own warlords, but Somalia has also been let down by its neighbors, by Ethiopia and Kenya, by Yemen, by all the neighbors who closed their gates to the refugees.
What do you know about the warlords who have been heading up the factions in the Civil War? They just declared a truce. But are these people who you know personally at all?
No, I do not know them. No, I have never met them. In my opinion, in fact, their rabies injection are overdue. They should have been given rabies injections the way mad dogs are. And whereas they're now being treated as respectable persons and ambassadors and other people are talking to them. And some people are paying homage to them. These are people who've committed murderous crimes against the Somali people. And, you know, Nuremberg trials should also be set up so that Siad Barre, who lives in Nigeria, not very far from where I am now speaking, in Kaduna, he lives about 2.5 hours' drive from where I live. All these people should be made to pay for the crimes they committed against the innocent women and children, civilians and others.
We in the United States have really been trying to understand Somali culture, and we hear a lot about the clans in Somali culture and how what an important cultural unit they represent, and how the elders of the clans are among the most important leaders in Somalia. Can you help us to understand clans a little bit? Maybe you can personalize that for us a little bit and tell us a little bit about your coming of age within a clan and what that meant.
Well, before answering that question in the way you've put it to me, I should perhaps like to relate the question to the issue at hand. That is, how much is are the ideas of clan bearing on what is happening in Somalia in the civil war? In other words, what have Aidid and Ali Mahdi, what have they in common with the ideals of the clan? My view is that neither of these persons, in fact, none of the warlords represents the ideals and the idea of a clan. Now, Aidid and Ali Mahdi are said to belong to the same clan. Now, a clan simply means a lineage into which you are born. It also means that when you are born, your ancestral clan is the one to which or to whom you owe allegiance. Now, if this were the case, then the situation would be a lot simpler. And the reason is because Aidid and Ali Mahdi would both be talked to by the elders of the clan. They would be made to come and explain their positions to someone who has power over their activities. Clans that are neighbors have often known how to deal with each other. And whenever somebody oversteps the mark, the elders of the clan traditionally would sit down together, talk things over, and solve the problem. And whoever seems to have lost either cattle or, you know, a son or a daughter would be given compensation for the loss. And everything would be made peaceful again. Now, this is not a clan warfare, because nowadays, if Aidid or one of his men were to kill somebody, you do not go to the members of the clan to which Aidid is said to belong to. You do not request that they give you recompense for the evils done to you, because they owe no allegiance to the traditional allegiance of the clan. Clans are simply larger family units whose people are said to live in a given area in any country. When 20th century politics and 21-year dictatorship enters the picture, there is no clan. Every dog for himself.
What's left of your clan?
Like every Somali, I too was born into a family. Like every human being, I was born into a family. But I was born in a city, brought up on the ways of the city. And was also brought up not to put any faith in the ideas of the Klan. I was brought up to think of myself as a person, as an individual, and as a Somali. And this is what I've always believed in. I do not believe in the ideas of the Klan, and do not know, in fact, many of my friends who do.
My guest is exiled Somali writer Nuruddin Farah. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Somali writer Nuruddin Farah. He's speaking to us from his home in Nigeria. I'm wondering, you know, we've been all watching TV pictures and photographs of the young men driving those technicals, the jeeps with the guns on them. I'm wondering if you've seen any pictures like that and recognized any of the people, if you've recognized them as the sons of people you knew or anything like that.
I do recognize some of the people who are there, but you see, I also do recognize some of the young people who fled the fighting in Somalia. And the difference, let's say, between the insanity displayed to me by people of my son's generation. My son is 22, 23 now. And I saw him recently when I was in Kenya. And the unreasonableness with which he expresses himself is, in fact, not very, very different from the irrationality displayed by these mad youths who man these technicals. I say this because the only difference is my son hasn't joined one of the warring factions. And let me explain also what one of the reasons why this is so. For 21 years, Somalis have been used to making shortcuts to achieve everything. In other words, there was no morality to speak of, no self-honor, no dignity. Everyone was into corruption. Between one day and the next, the poorest could be made by Siad Barre the wealthiest, and vice versa. In other words, the wealthiest could be made the poorest the following day. And all because Siad Barre was interested in the power greed to continue ruling the country. Now, when young people are brought up on such a white corruption, when they know the humiliation that their parents go through in order to feed them, in order to clothe them, even young people, wives, daughters and sons, lose respect for the master of the household or for the mistress of the household.
So you feel that when you look at the young men riding around with automatic weapons, that you understand why that's happening?
I understand why that's happening, because what they're actually doing is they're simply copying Siad Barre. Siad Barre came to power through the power of the gun. The warlords are also trying to do the same. Now, these young technicals are on drugs, the majority of them. The majority of them are on drugs brought in from Kenya and Ethiopia. I can also see why, and the reason is because the majority of these people have had no schooling as such. They don't actually come from homes that we would consider to be homes. They come from roadsides. They are the urchins of the city of Mogadishu. They're the refuse of a city. So naturally, if they're able to get everything because of the guns that they own, then naturally one can understand them.
In our previous interview, you described Somalia's civil war, famine, and dictatorship as manifestations of the same mental disorder, a society that's gone insane. Do you still see it that way?
Yes. you know, to be able to understand what's happening in Somalia, or to be able to understand civil wars, one has to think of twins having a war, twins having a fight. When two people who are closest to each other fall out, poison comes out, and nothing can stop them. And this is when you actually need someone from the outside to come in and to see that such animosity is not visited upon the weaker members of that society.
You know, it's interesting you should mention that, because one of the things that's been very confusing for me, anyways, is that Somalia is one of those places in which the fighting isn't about ethnic fighting. It's not a religious war. I mean, the people are of the same language and the same religion, the same background. So it makes the fighting more difficult to understand.
It is more difficult to understand, and when two brothers have a fight, nothing can stop the fight. Nothing. They kill each other. And the reason is because they know each other very well, or they think they know each other very well. And they hurt themselves in such unforgivable fashions that there is no way you can resolve this. Now, it is perhaps, I mean, I suppose one must pay homage to Mr. Oakley, the American envoy, who managed to get these two madmen together. I don't know what language mad people speak. I mean, I do not know. There have been many, many questions that I haven't been able to answer myself. And one of the questions is, what if a nation has decides to commit suicide? I mean, the Somali nation seems to have decided to commit suicide. What are the responsibilities of the other nations? And how much interference can they make? When I was talking to various governments in Africa and Europe, the majority of them kept on saying, we do not want to be accused of interfering in the affairs of another nation. But when the nation is, you know, when the bloodletting of a nation is so savage, what do you do? I mean, do you simply watch it? Do you stand aside and watch people commit suicide? It is very un-Christian, it's very un-Islamic.
Have you lost friends or family to the civil war or to the famine?
Well, two things. One is, I do not know is the honest answer. But I must have also lost a lot more than a friend and family. I've lost. Well, it seems I've misplaced my own pride in my Somaliness. I seem to lose touch with it every now and again. I seem to be unable even to continue writing. I seem to be visited by self-doubts more often than I have ever known myself to be.
You say it's been hard for you to write. Have you been writing? And if so, what have you been writing about?
I've aborted two novels, I think. I've aborted a novel that I started long before the Civil War began, but it was about the Civil War in Somalia. And aborted it when the reality of the Civil War hit my consciousness. I couldn't simply continue depicting in fiction which was taking place in reality. And so that's two attempts at writing a novel about the Civil War. I've been of late spending more and more time on a non-fiction book about refugees, African refugees in Europe. And I think it's easier to continue touching base with my own consciousness when I'm dealing with facts and figures, which I can refer to when sitting in a library in Kituna or in London or in Stockholm. So I've been working on a book about the consequences of a civil war. In other words, civil war gives birth to such horrors that many, many people flee. And when they flee, they do not become human beings. They become refugees.
I guess wherever you travel, there are probably other Africans like you who have been forced to become refugees. I guess you could say that the face of the whole world is changing.
Yes, the face of the whole world is changing. I was recently in touch with a friend of mine from Bosnia, whom I hadn't seen for very many years. Now, he's also a refugee somewhere in Germany. Some of my friends are refugees somewhere else. But, you know, I think some of us are luckier as refugees than others. You see, because I become no longer a refugee. I'm not a refugee in the sense that I am an exile. See, I'm a writer in exile. It's a more chic to be a writer in exile than to be a stateless refugee whom no one knows. If the truth...
There's a status in it. Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, I could pick up the telephone if I'm in real trouble, and I would call some of my friends and say, I'm in trouble. I'm at the airport, I'm being held, they're not letting me in. Could you let me in? I'm more and more worried about the people who've become casualties of the civil war in Somalia and who don't have anyone to telephone and who are being humiliated and robbed and raped and tortured by Kenyan, Yemeni and corrupt officials.
Nuruddin Farah spoke with us from his home in Nigeria. His trilogy about dictatorship has been published in the United States by Grey Wolf. The books are Sweet and Sour Milk, Sardines, and Close Sesame. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.